Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, in our last two programs, I gave you a quick overview of the history leading to the printing of the King James Bible. Now, it's also known as the Authorized Bible. And so why is it called the Authorized Version or the Authorized Bible? Well, I'll explain that in today's program. What I want to do today is I want to split this program maybe into two parts. We'll see how it goes. For the first part, I want to finish our history of what led to the printing of the King James Bible. And then I want to begin to discuss the method James used to produce the almost near perfect translation of the Bible into the English at that time. Now, it's not a perfect translation. We know there are some difficulties in the translation just in trying to understand. Some of it's a little bit awkward. But by and large, it is probably the most near perfect translation of the Bible into English for all time. And so we can discuss that a little bit more as we go through this. But it's kind of interesting. There's been like several twists in the history of the Bible, and I have we'll just talk about those as we go through this. But it is kind of interesting. Again, if you remember back to those first two programs, if you haven't listened to them yet, I would suggest that you do that. But remember, the first twist in this whole history of what led to the printing of the King James Bible was that a Catholic-dominated clergy in England did not want the laity to read the Bible in English. They wanted to maintain control. And of course, at that time, at the very beginning of those two programs, I told you that the main Latin of the scholars was, well, it was Latin. And your English laity didn't know Latin, so they couldn't read the Bible, and they had to totally rely on what the priest or the clergy said. So that is really interesting in itself. Now, there was this Bible war in England, and we talked to you about that. Eventually, the Bible war in England became tangled with Henry VIII's battle to divorce his first wife. And his first wife was a princess from Spain. Now, the severing of the English church from Rome really had little to do with the Protestant Reformation that was fomenting in Europe. And we talked to you about some of those things as well. But Henry wanted out of his marriage so he could produce a legal heir to the throne. In other words, he wanted a male heir. He did have children with his first wife. But there's a lot of twists and turns in that, and we don't need to get into that history. But what he felt was, well, look, if it meant that I become the head of the English church, then so be it. But overall, we have to remember that Henry wanted to remain Catholic, and he really... He wasn't necessarily very much in support of, translating the Bible from Latin into English because, again, he was very Catholic himself. And really, if you understand anything about true Catholics, they're not really Bible readers. They do not get their doctrines solely from the Bible. And the Bible really is there, I think, basically just to make them look good. Even when I was raised Catholic, I mean, we went to Catholic Mass. It was in Latin. You couldn't even understand it. And so a lot of the people that go to at that time went to Catholic Mass, they, unless they knew Latin, they didn't even really understand what was going on. Now, after Henry won his fight with Rome, and again, remember, he was a very proud and arrogant king, but he soon realized that he had this incredible dilemma on his hands. The nation was bitterly divided between Catholics and Protestants. And so, again, he saw himself really still as Catholic, but there was this English church. It was severed from the Pope. And, of course, it was not recognized necessarily by the Pope. But there was this division now starting between Catholics and Protestants. And so the Protestant Reformation had entered into England, but it wasn't because of Henry VIII's doing. Now, he recognized that even the newly established English church was splintering. It was really splintering into separate factions. And, you know, it was really by about 1530 that the Catholic clergy or the English clergy, you know, from the Church of England, they realized that they really couldn't prevent the spread of Tyndale's translations. They couldn't stop Luther's tracts. And so what Henry did is he really wanted his counselors or his clergy to produce a new official Bible to attempt to reunite the nation. Now, that became almost an impossible task. And, you know, the bishops couldn't agree. And so when I'm talking about the bishops, the English bishops could not agree. And because of all their deep disagreement, and we'll talk a little bit more as we go through this, they could not agree to even start working on a new translation. So by 1535, nothing had been done. And there was this horrible history of this back and forth wrangling over the Bible within the English church. I mean, even Henry did some persecution of people that really wanted to, you know, have the Bible accessed by everybody. I mean, he was not really for Protestantism. So essentially what happened, there was these multiple versions of the English Bible that were produced by the different feuding factions. And so essentially what happened is they would make a translation of the Bible and they would add their own notes or explanation of the scriptures. Now, that at that time it was called glosses, G-L-O-S-S-E-S. And so in other words, once the Bible began to be translated, then the different factions, like there were Puritans, you know, there were Calvinists, there were the Presbyterians. They all wanted to have their own spin on what the scriptures really meant. So it actually created even more confusion. Some of the translations were good. Some of them were not so good. But it was kind of a new kind of war. It wasn't a war of Bible translation. It became a war of Bible interpretation. Now, when Henry died, his daughter, Mary Tudor, well, she took the throne in 1553. And if anybody knows the history, and again, I'm just trying to give you a big overview, she was an avowed Catholic. And what she began to do is she began to persecute and even execute Bible translators and readers. She was obviously known as Bloody Mary. So she did execute people. But if you look at these translations of the Bible, one of the more well-known one was called the Geneva Bible. And the one thing that was really good about the Geneva Bible is the Geneva Bible organized it into chapters and verses. And that's why we have chapters and verses today, because they wanted to make it easier. When the Bible was first translated, it was just like a scroll only on pages. And so to find anything would be next to impossible. So the Geneva Bible really did a good job of, you know, separating the Bible into chapters and verses. But the reason why it's called the Geneva Bible is the Protestants that Mary was persecuting all fled to Geneva, Switzerland. And so while they were there in Geneva, then they produced this Geneva Bible, which was an English translation. It wasn't, you know, in the German language or the Swiss language at all. But the problem with this book, it had a heavy Calvinist orientation. Like I said, there were other Bible translations that had the Puritan views, and you had others that had the Presbyterian views. And so it really became a really big problem. And there was another version called the Bishop's Bible, you know, which actually was probably more accurate than the Geneva Bible in its translation, but it was just absolutely cold and boring. Cold and boring to read. There was no continuity or fluidity in the text. It was just like perfect translation, so it didn't really kind of all blend together. But, you know, that really did create problems in the nation with Mary. And, of course, then we know that Mary Tudor, you know, finally died, and then Elizabeth I took over. But there's an interesting other twist in here that's really kind of interesting. And here we had, you know, people fighting the Bible translation. A lot of it was Catholic. It was anti the laity having the Bible. And then you get this fight between Protestants and against Protestants. Well, the Catholics actually came back with a counterattack. Eventually people did calm down and they accepted that the fact they could not stop what Tyndall had done. They couldn't stop the publication of an English translated Bible. And so essentially what happened is the Catholics got involved because, you know, under Elizabeth the First, Protestantism was rising. And in fact, you know, Mary, we call her Bloody Mary because, well, she went after the Protestants. Well, Elizabeth I actually went after the Catholics. And so here the Protestants at the time of Mary had to go to Geneva to start, the translation of the Bible. Well, the Catholics in the country, remember, there's still a Catholic England, even though there was the Church of England, there was still Catholic England, and you still have that today. I mean, even in the Church of England, or the Anglican Church today, it's the dominant church in England, but you still have Catholics. And, you know, we know that Tony Blair, you know, converted back to Catholicism. And, of course, there's been a big movement even in the Anglican Church to reconcile with Rome, which is really kind of, if you could resurrect some of the people from let's say, the Middle Ages, or maybe around the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, they'd be shocked that people wanted to go back to the church in Rome. But anyway, so there was this another Catholic counterattack, but it's not that they tried to get rid of the English Bible translation. What the Catholic counterattack was is they came up with a Catholic English version of the Bible. And it is known, still known today, as the Douay Rheims version. And I'm going to read to you just a little bit from a book that I would recommend that you get. And this book is called A Visual History of the King James Bible. And it is by Donald L. Brake. And if you get this book, I mean, I highly recommend it to you. What I'm giving you is just really a short overview. But this Visual History of the King James Bible, it gives detailed history. And if you're really interested in this, if these programs have inspired you to know more, there's really a lot more information than I'm giving you. But on page 68 of this book, A Visual History of the King James Bible, he writes, he says, while the battle for a vernacular Bible had ended, the war for theology intertwined with Bible versions had begun. Rome responded to the popularity of the 16th century English version with a new interest in translation. The Latin Bible that Jerome, and again, that was an ancient biblical scholar, and he was an ascetic. This is a parenthesis in his sentence. The Latin Bible that Jerome translated in the 4th and 5th centuries became the unofficial Roman Catholic Bible. At the time of the Council of Trent in 1546, the Catholic Church had not yet authorized an edition of the Vulgate. And so when you look at the King James Bible, it's called the Authorized Version because when James printed it, this was the official authorized version of the Bible that could be used in church services. So that's why it's called authorized. But even the Catholic Church in the mid 16th century didn't even have an authorized version of the Vulgate. So the Council of Trent declared the Louvain edition, the official church edition of the Bible, but even the Louvain edition lacked full sanction of the highest ecclesiastical authority. Nevertheless, it was considered an authoritative edition. Now, I think even that history should show all of us that the Catholic Church really doesn't put great importance on the Bible. They didn't even have an authorized version that they wanted their members to read. And remember, Catholic doctrine says that only the priest can really interpret the Bible for you. And of course, we know that that is not even what the Bible dictates. So essentially what happened is when Elizabeth I was going about prosecuting the Catholics, they also wanted to kind of convert more people in England to Catholicism. And so because so many people were already used to an English Bible, they decided they were going to translate the Latin Vulgate into English. And they did this in one of the Low Countries, or they did it in Antwerp. And it's called the Douay Rheims Bible. Now, here's why that got started. I'm reading from another book. And again, I'd recommend this book to you. And I'm going to list these on my Twitter account so that you can get the exact title and the author. In this book, it's called The People's Bible, and it's by Derek Wilson. And again, this is it's a really good book on the Bible. And all of these books came out, by the way, in 2011 at the 400th anniversary of the printing of the King James Bible. So here's what he writes. He says, speaking about this little town in Antwerp, he said, "It was here that William Allen, a Jesuit biblical scholar of considerable repute, had established an English college for the purpose of training young Englishmen to be Catholic missionaries in their own land. Reactionary in his intentions, Allen knew the importance of being radical in his methods. He decided to take a leaf out of the enemy's book. The Protestants had made the English Bible the focus of their appeal to the people. Very well, the students of Douay must be equally well-versed in the Scripture." And so he decided, well, hey, the Protestants made this English translation. If we're going to get converts to Catholicism, we need an English version. And so this is a note, I guess, he wrote. It says, "Since it is of great consequence that they should be familiar with the text of Holy Scripture and its more approved meanings, and have at their finger ends all of those passages which are correctly used by Catholics in support of our faith or impiously misused by heretics in opposition to the Church's faith, we provide for them as a means by which they may gain this power." So you have to understand the war that was going on is, remember, people were using the Scriptures to prove Catholic doctrine wrong. And so what they wanted to do with the Douay version is they wanted to have Scriptures that would prove Catholic doctrine right. And so the whole bottom line is the Douay translation of the Bible, it was finished, I think, in around 1578. It really is a Catholic version of the Bible. And when I believe, I really wanted to, come to a knowledge of the truth, I had read the Douay version of the Bible, but I realized, growing up in the Catholic high school, even the priests would show us at times where the Catholic Church was wrong. And so, I discovered on my own, if you look at Exodus 20, chapter 20 in the King James Version, and if you look at Exodus chapter 20 in the Douay Version, it's radically different. And this Exodus 20 is the chapter about the Ten Commandments. And so if you look at it, if you compare text from the King James Version with the Douay Version, commandment number 2, the one against idolatry or, worshiping idols, is gone. It just doesn't even exist. And, of course, that would make sense because the Catholic Church, they love statues and they love representations of Jesus. And I remember at Easter ceremonies kissing the feet on the crucifix. And that's all would be called idolatry by the Bible. It's an affront to God to have, an idol to look at. Okay, the other commandment that's totally rewritten is the fourth commandment. And in the King James Version, it says, remember to keep holy the seventh day. And that's not an exact quote. It's I'm paraphrasing from my thinking or my mind or my memory. But in the Douay Version, it says, remember to keep holy the Lord's Day. So there's no mention of a day of the week. And of course, we know that Sunday is actually the first day of the week. But the Sabbath, the true Sabbath of God, that's outlined in the Bible, is the seventh day of the week. And you can ask anybody in the world what the seventh day of the week is. And most people know it's Saturday. Saturday is the seventh day. And Sunday is the first day of the week. Now, if you to make up the difference, remember the 10th commandment says you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, you should not covet his neighbor's goods. So essentially, to make sure there are still 10 commandments, they took the 10th commandment and split it into two. So in the Douay version, it's one of the 9th commandment says you shall not covet your neighbor's goods. And I think the 10th commandment says you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. So that's how they reconciled it. So again, this was just a Catholic version of the Bible to support what the Catholic Church teaches. And of course, they teach the Trinity. And I already told you the last couple programs about how they just entered that in the letters of John in the New Testament. So it is interesting that's another, you know, war or battle with the Bible. So essentially what happened is the Catholics got involved and they decided to make their own version, and so they could then prove themselves true. So anyway, that's what began to happen. So there was all this foment over the English Bibles that had all these extra teaching. And then, of course, then there was the Catholic version. And so by the time that James I, or he's James the VI of Scotland, came to the throne, he needed to get rid of all of that. He wanted to get rid of all the interpretation. He wanted to get rid of the Calvinist teaching. He wanted to get rid of the Puritan teaching. He wanted to get rid of all of that, and he wanted to just have a pure English translation of the Bible that everyone could read and that could be the official Bible that was used in the Church of England. And so there was one other thing that he wanted to do, and we can talk about this a little bit more probably in the next program. But he really did not like the Geneva Bible because it was full of Calvinist teaching. And one thing that James I really believed in, he believed in absolute monarchy. In other words, you know, the king on the throne was God's, it was God's choice to put him on the throne. And so he believed that God wanted him to rule absolutely. And so the Calvinists did not like that. And so he really wanted to get rid of all those extra interpretations and all that. Now, what was really interesting and what really got all of this started is it was a Puritan leader that went to James that he said, look, we really need to, stop all the confusion. And so essentially we're done with the history now. And they wanted to get rid of all the confusion about the Bible and about the English Bible. So a Puritan leader got together with James, and then they decided to go ahead, and they had this Hampton Court conference. And I've been in Hampton Court, and it's absolutely, Henry VIII built it. It's an absolutely beautiful facility. But he called this conference, it's known in history as the Hampton Court Conference. And on January 1st, 1604, they got together and they officially started this massive translation project. And James really set some pretty strict guidelines to ensure that the translators stayed objective. In other words, there were going to be some translators that were Puritan. There was going to be some translators that were Calvinist. There were going to be some translators of it, a different persuasion. But he really set probably about 20 guidelines to make sure they all stayed objective. But also, what he did is he divided the Bible up among six teams of scholars. And two of them were set up at Westminster, Oxford, and Cambridge. So you had two teams at Westminster, you had two teams at Oxford, and you had two teams at Cambridge. Now, he also ensured that they used only the best Hebrew and Greek texts. And what they did is they took advantage of every available version to compare the variant readings. And so, they had, what Tyndale had done, and they had what Wycliffe had done. And, they had the Latin Vulgate. But they went and they tried to find the best Greek and Hebrew texts. And so it took them 4 years, if you can believe that. It took them 4 years to complete this task. Then, when that translation was done, they subjected it to an additional 2 years of further checking. And so essentially what these teams all came back together and they swapped their work, and then they checked each other. So it was amazing. And then after another 9 months of grueling proof, then the Authorized Bible was printed in 1611. So there was a long time spent in getting this Bible together. And so it is really quite interesting. And I think all of us should consider that many have died to give us the right to own and read and study this incredible book. And, you know, do we value that right? You know, and here's the point. If we don't, we could really lose it. I mean, we could lose the Bible. You know, we know that Bible prophecy said there is this coming clash in religion, and it's going to be basically, you know, the Catholics are going to be, you know, taking on the world and wanting their doctrine, you know, to be to be king or to be the chief doctrine. And so it's time that we really consider all these things. Well, it looks like I'm running out of time today. And so next time we'll discuss how King James changed the world by publishing Israel's holy book. Now, you can write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.